Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung Shulman.
I'm Radha Iyengar.
You're back!
Yay!
I'm back!
We're so excited. And today we have a special guest.
This is Susanna Bloom.
Welcome. We are very excited to have you.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Before we get going on talking to Susanna and telling you the delicious drinks that we're drinking this week, we have a few announcements. First of which is that this is kind of our last regular podcast of the year, we think.
Probably.
We are going to have a special edition out sometime next week, which will be a live podcast that we're recording at the Air Command and Staff College and Air War College at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. We decided that was a great idea to travel to Alabama in December just after a special election. So,
sweet home Alabama.
What
everybody.
Could go wrong?
Well, everybody can look forward to that. That will be out next week and should be kind of a year in review. And Star Wars commentary would be my guess. We also have a gift guide in the works. Is that right, ladies?
It's going to be fabulous. It involves weird books and meat products and sparkly Rothies.
That's right.
Yeah, Rado's books were the weirdest. I'm not going to lie.
Listen, guys, I'm an economist. I try really hard to be normal, but there's only so far it's going to go.
Okay.
And I guess that's all of our announcements. Oh, I guess last but not least on the announcements, which we should do every time, but we don't, is a reminder that none of us speak for our employers, past or present.
Very much so.
Our opinions are entirely our own, thank heavens, and don't get us in trouble. With that,
this week we are drinking, I can't read it.
It's the Iron Horse Russian Cuvée.
That was first bottled in honor of the Reagan-Gorbachev talks in the 80s during the Reagan administration and was gifted to us by one Ellie Powell,
who was a classmate of mine in graduate school and is currently an amazing professor at the University of Wisconsin. So thank you, Ellie. And as usual, anyone else who would like to send us booze or other things to drink, but mostly booze during our podcast is welcome to reach out and we'll send you all the details on that. Radha, what are you drinking?
I should also plug that my mother, who folks may remember from the Mother's Day episode.
How could we forget?
Decided to gift me a classic eggnog. By classic, she means a 30 proof eggnog that contains Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey, rum, brandy, and blended whiskey. And then, I don't know, possibly nog, but mostly those other things. And so if I fall over partway through this episode, now you know why.
How do you make a 30 proof eggnog?
Are you supposed to mix it with something?
I don't know. My mom gave me this bottle and that's what I'm drinking. I
like some milk
questions.
Or some eggs
or a nap. Yeah.
Maybe an IV.
Okay. Well, this is going to be an excellent episode. I can tell already. But before we get into our usual fare, we're going to start with the bombshell questions.
Yes. So Susanna Bloom started at CNES a few months ago. She is a fellow in the Defense Strategy and Assessments Program. I was previously working for Bob Work, none other, as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Programs and Plans. So first, to get to know Susanna, we need to ask, what is the best meal you've ever had while traveling?
I feel like I should preface this exercise with the fact that I am like terrible at picking favorites generally.
I had to ask Susanna, like, did I need to offer more specificity or like...
I mean, your favorite is like so context dependent, but...
Pick a context, any context.
I've narrowed it down. I thought a lot about this and I think, you know, when you're traveling courtesy of the United States Department of Defense, you get to go to all these really interesting places. But often you never get off post, right? So like you go to Okinawa and you eat at the Macaroni Grill. True story.
Amazing.
I had an amazing meal in Okinawa one time, actually.
Yeah.
Not at a Macaroni Grill.
So not at a Macaroni
Grill. It was like
grill.
My third or fourth trip to Japan. And, you know, we just decided like no matter what happens, we're getting off post to get some actual Japanese food. And so we landed actually quite late at night. It was the only time that we didn't have, you know, official dinners or obligations scheduled. And, you know, a couple colleagues and I were like, we're just doing it. We're going out in town. We're going to find some authentic food. We found this amazing ramen bar with, you know, full of salary men just getting off work. Really authentic experience. Probably the best bowl of soup I ever had in my life. And, you know, we finished the meal and attempt to pay. It turns out they don't take American credit cards as a great many Japanese establishments don't for security reasons. I have actually no idea what the reasons are, but it turns out it's pretty common. And so one of my colleagues left the two of us there as like collateral and spent about literally an hour and a half running around Tokyo attempting to find an ATM that would accept his card so we could pay for our dinner and leave the restaurant. Which, and afterwards we concluded is probably why they don't let us off post.
Right. It all makes sense now. What is the book you have either reread the most or owned the longest?
So I struggled with whether to answer this question as like a professional or as a human being. And I ended up going with human being.
Excellent choice.
You know, it turns out it's all fiction. Like just this past summer, I read The Rook and Stiletto by Daniel Malley. I don't know if you guys have heard of him. Mm-mm. Phenomenal books. Fantasy series. I've already read both of them twice and they didn't come out that long ago. I used to think that I really didn't like sci-fi or fantasy. It turns out I really do, as long as the characters are really rich and well-developed and you can buy into them.
And aren't all men.
Lots of really strong women in these two books, actually.
Fascinating.
Passes the Bechdel test easily.
I'll have to check those out. What is the fan club or fan community you have been a part of in your life?
So this one I actually found completely impossible to answer, and I can come up with two reasons for why that might be. The first is that I'm just like definitionally not a joiner.
We get a lot of that around here.
Yeah.
Is that not an... I mean, the other...
Rada had to say that she liked cheetahs or some weird shit like that. So like, I understand.
Look, I adopted a cheetah.
Okay,
adopted.
Yeah. I mean, the alternative is that I've just like so thoroughly repressed my middle school self that I can't remember. But the closest thing I could come up with is in college, I had season tickets to the Baltimore Symphony, nerd alert.
Wow.
Pretty nerdy.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. I'll have to explore that later and get through the questions first. Who is the Twitter or Facebook crush that you have? And you have only been on Twitter for a brief period of time as a former government person who was terrified of Twitter for a while. And now you're allowed to express your views to whoever wants to see them.
Yeah. That Twitter is like, I mean, Twitter, I don't think existed when I went into government. And so it's been a whole new world for me these past couple months. But I've really enjoyed following some of the journalists in like the defense trade press. And like Aaron Mehta, of course, but Valerie Encina.
Sure.
Amazing.
I've never met her, but she's got this great Twitter feed. Just this afternoon, actually, she was like taking a poll on what, you know, military aircraft shape Christmas cookie cutters she should be buying.
She should talk to Stephanie Carvin.
Exactly. Stephanie Carvin made an F-16 a couple of days ago.
It was an F-15.
I'm sorry, F-15. Pardon
but it
me.
It looked like a 22 and what? It would generate a whole lot of discussion.
Wow.
Yeah, anyway,
that went further than I thought it was going to.
Wow. The military cookie cutter options on Etsy are a lot like more.
Oh, we might have to add those to the gift guide
than
ladies.
I would have expected.
Absolutely,
but you know, B-52s, totally. B-2s, B-1s, F-15s, the classic F-14.
Can I hand out Predators? No.
You sure.
Know, I didn't see any unmanned on Etsy, but
I feel like those might be a little too fragile to make into a cookie. Like they're not. They have too many like narrow pieces. I'll explore this.
Yeah, maybe they need some like candy accoutrement.
I think we should also have tanks and not a tank.
Tanks and not a tanks, yes.
Yeah.
Excellent.
All right, so I'm excited about this question because I have to disclose that Susanna, in addition to being a defense nerd like extraordinaire, was also an art history major, which is like one of the coolest backgrounds I've ever heard of for a defense nerd. What is your favorite museum? And I recognize this is probably going to freak you out the most, but go ahead.
This was really hard. This was really, really hard because there are a lot to choose from. I've spent a lot of my life in museums. In addition to having, you know, gotten my bachelor's in it, my father was a museum director until he retired a couple years ago. But I think my favorite art museum right now, and it changes day to day, as the Palazzo Borghese in Rome.
Oh.
You know, the Borgia were such an interesting, important political family. They were also pretty tremendous patrons of the arts. Mm-hmm. And there's a series of sculptures there by Gianlorenzo Bernini that are just some of my favorite pieces out of Greek and Roman anthropology. And they're gorgeous. It's a beautiful place. Also, like, lovely pastoral setting in this park in the middle of the city. My favorite military museum is actually the Australian War Memorial. The placement of the Australian War Memorial in the city of Canberra, which you have a direct line of sight from the Parliament down a road that is essentially paved in red. And the idea is to remind members of Parliament as they're considering, escalating, engaging in conflict, sending, young men and women in harm's way, of the cost of those decisions. It's a very powerful place.
Wow. I will have to visit that. If anyone wants to invite the Bombshell members to Australia, just saying, we'd like a field trip.
Speaking of,
is your favorite geek field trip? And I'm sure you've been on many.
Yeah. So I went to SICE. And any listeners who did that will also know that SICE has a very long and proud tradition of staff rides. And so my favorite one of those had to have been a Cold War staff ride that we did starting in Berlin.
Oh, yeah. That was a few years ago.
Yeah. Going south down the old East-West German border and ending in Prague. And it was incredible. We had this concept on the trip called the walk to sausage ratio. which
that could go a lot of directions. It's
going in the strictly culinary direction.
If we don't call this episode the walk to sausage ratio, then I think we have failed.
I think we have failed.
Moving on to a question that I know that you also dread along with me, Aaron, you can ask this question.
I'm going to let Radha ask this question.
Oh, Radha, welcome back. Ask
since
the question.
She's back.
Thank you. What is your favorite statistical distribution?
Normal. I had to Google this.
That's fine.
I had to Google statistical distributions. And it turns out that there's one called normal, and it sounded pretty good to me.
There is, and it does. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll move on.
Okay. The reason we wanted to bring Susanna on today is, every week, every 2 weeks, you've heard us talk about what's going on with the defense budget, what's going on in the Hill with regard to the Continuing Resolution and Budget Control Act and everything else. And all of these sound really ephemeral and kind of vague, and DOD has talked for years as though the sky is falling. So the main two reasons wanted to bring Susanna on was to tell us what on earth is going on Congress right now with regard to a budget deal for fiscal year 18 or even longer. And then, but secondly, what's really more important is how is this total chaos actually impacting DOD on the inside? Because I feel like we hear a lot about how, you know, if we don't give us a budget, then we'll never be able to win a war again. Or if we don't get a budget, then terrible things will fall from the sky. But the reality day to day is actually a lot more complex than that. And having you talk through that would be really awesome. So I'll let you start with what's going on the Hill with regard to defense budget, because we talk about it all the time. And I feel like there's always a new drama every week.
Yeah, what's going on the Hill? It's a great question. Authorizers provide the Department of Defense and other, you know, the executive branch writ large with authority to do different things. Those authorities come with certain amounts of money to do different things. The appropriators are the ones who actually provide the funds. I think a lot of people were confused. Why are we still talking about a government shutdown when we have a National Defense Authorization Act, an NDAA? Well, government shuts down if funds aren't appropriated, and funds have yet to be appropriated.
So they might have permission to spend the money, but they don't actually have any money.
They don't actually have any money. Exactly. And so where we are now is that the Budget Control Act of 2011, those caps are still in place. The base budget cap for fiscal year 19 is $549 billion. So
that would be less than what's been authorized.
It is considerably less than both what has been authorized and what the two appropriations bills currently contain.
It's like less by an entire State Department and then some.
And so what is happening now, as far as anybody can tell, is Congress is working on some kind of deal to the 2 year budget deals that we saw in 2014 and again in 2016. I think we're looking at another 2 year deal that increases the caps a little bit, probably chucks a bunch of money into OCO and overseas contingency operations funds. We can talk more about those if you're interested. And gets us to an answer that nobody really likes, but that folks can generally live with.
So with all of that going on, with the threat of the government shutdown last Friday, and then one that could possibly come up as of, you know, a week and a half from now, what is going on in terms of planning within the Department of Defense? Like, does everybody just get thrown out in the streets? Does the military get paid? Do we get to new contracts? Do we have to start over again? Like, what's the chaos related to that?
So there are many layers of chaos. basically, what's been going on since October 1st is that the government has been funded at the FY17 level, which is about $606 billion base and OCO together. So promised growth doesn't materialize during that time period. You know, the president's request for FY18 was $639 billion. You know, that extra $33 billion doesn't show up during a continuing resolution. It's kind of difficult for the department to manage its burn rate under those circumstances because they don't know at the beginning of the fiscal year how much money they're going to have at the end. And it's difficult because you can't start any new programs or sign any new contracts while that's happening. And so, you know, all of the technological innovation that we talk about, the need to kind of start new platforms, new demonstrations, new prototypes, none of that can happen under CR. So it's damaging to the department and to the security of the nation on a number of different levels. When you layer the threat of a shutdown, which is more to your question, Lauren, over top of that, you add a whole other level of chaos and take further bandwidth of the department's senior leadership and all the way down through the ranks to figure out how to execute a shutdown, how to actually do that. You know, whether or not it happens, you still have to plan for it. It still takes a lot of time and energy.
And contractors and vendors have to plan for that, too. I mean, that was a huge headache for us running a small business in both the sequester years and the last time there was a shutdown.
Yeah, I think Radha, Susanna, and I were all in the 2013 shutdown where I had to show up for work every day and not get paid until later with no promise of getting paid.
I had to make payroll with questions about when we were going to get our invoices funded.
Yeah, it's a lot of chaos. Aside, you know, going through the process of deciding who in your organization is accepted or not is difficult and time consuming.
It's also really emotional, if I remember correctly. Like, people get strangely offended if they're not part of that, like, the critical employees.
They're labeled non-essential, which feels really marginalizing.
I mean, to OPM's credit, they have changed non-essential to accepted or not accepted, right? There's been, but the feeling is still the same. It's bad for morale.
And, you know, Bob Hale from 2013 had really excellent congressional testimony highlighting this point, like the repeated sequesters, furloughs, shutdowns, like there are real morale effects to this, these labels that I think are just worth keeping in mind, not to mention the actual operating limitations that we had in 2013.
I think that's right. In terms of the uniform military, you know, what Congress did in 2013 was pass a continuing resolution for military pay only. So there was no question about whether or not the military could show up to work. There was a question about whether or not they were going to be paid on time. If that shutdown had gone over a payday, there was nobody in to actually run the payroll.
No one at DFAS in Ohio to push the buttons. Interesting.
And so, you know, Congress tried subsequently then to pass the Pay Our Military Act, and they did that. And then the shutdown for DOD at least ended before that became an actual problem. It remained a theoretical problem. But something that people forget is that the majority of DOD civilian employees don't work in Washington.
Right.
They're from outside the Beltway. They're in, you know, depots and shipyards, turning wrenches, keeping aircraft flying and ships at sea. And so when you shut down and those people all get sent home, there's also a really real impact on readiness.
Well, and that's certainly been the services claims. I mean, and it's readiness claims from the services are always kind of hard to adjudicate. We have maybe more evidence this year than we've had in others about some of the readiness challenges, especially in the Navy. But we've had aircraft mishaps, for example, across the services. Do you see a link between the budget challenges we've had, let's say, since the BCA went into effect and the readiness challenges? Or is it two things that kind of co-occur but could actually be quite distinct?
Yeah, I would agree with you that readiness is a lot more nuanced and complicated than the rhetoric would have you believe.
Yeah.
But I think there are a couple types of budgetary events that have an absolutely unambiguously negative impact on readiness. The first being sequestration,
which is devastating.
When the Defense Department had to take a $35 billion budget cut in the middle of the fiscal year.
And it was across the top. It was a 10% haircut across every account, every service, every department. No prioritization.
You know, anyone who's in the department at the time saw exercises got cut, training got cut, maintenance was cut, because those are the only, first of all, it was mandated, the haircut that you describe across the board. But when you have the little bit of discretion the department did have, when you have to take that kind of magnitude of cut in the middle of the fiscal year, there are only certain accounts that you can go to. You can't buy half a ship or a quarter of an airplane.
Right. That's a great point.
A lot of contracts have already been signed. The money's already gone. Right. And so you look to the things that you can adjust on a very short timeline. And unfortunately, a lot of those things have very direct impacts on readiness.
And a lot of that was out of the operations and maintenance and personnel accounts. Yeah. So big picture, kind of looking forward, I guess it seems like, I mean, although on paper, we're actually marching toward sequestration because the authorized budgets are way higher than the BCA. We sort of assume that there'll be some set of rational actors who basically either, like, worst case, I would guess, is what, like a year-long continuing resolution if they can't get an overall deal.
You know, I'm not sure the defense hawks are going to get on board with a year-long CR.
Oh, interesting.
It's, I mean, that's
but
really
damaging. Wouldn't they prefer that to the sequestration buzzsaw?
Hard to say.
Oh, that's fascinating. You're not making me feel better here, Susanna.
I'm sorry. I mean, truthfully, I don't know. Truthfully, I think it's a bit, I don't think it's a choice at this point between sequestration or year-long CR.
You think year-long CR is off the table?
I wouldn't call it off the table. Okay. But again, I think the more likely outcome is a deal, is some kind of two-year deal. Whether or not that happens by December 22nd when the current CR expires, I don't know.
Right.
But what's crazy in all of this, you guys may remember when Mika was on 2 weeks ago, it's not like Congress has nothing on its plate right now. Like, this is a big, big effing deal in terms of, like, the budget. But between DACA and CHIP and the tax plan, which is wrapped up in all of this.
And also sexual harassment investigations.
Like, they have just a little bit on their plate right now. And the idea of them being able to invest enough intellectual energy to get a real deal done versus just a kind of half measure deal done is going to require a lot.
My understanding is that all the effort right now is going into the tax deal negotiations, not into the overall budget negotiations. Now, maybe they're walking and chewing gum at the same time, but
they've done that really well before.
Yeah, I'm not like exactly holding my breath. So, Susanna, any parting shots, any words of wisdom, any glimmers of hope?
If we can look past the current, I don't even know what to call them, flail. You know, there's an awful lot of time and energy and ink and breath being spent on the number. How much is DOD going to get? Mm-hmm. And if there's any point that I could make, it would be that the balance in the defense program between the size of the force, the capability of the force, meaning investing in next generation advanced technologies, and the readiness of the force is much, much more important than what that actual top line number ends up being. In addition to whether or not the defense budget and program is aligned with the strategy, right?
We'll get to that a little bit later in the show. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, those are the things where, you know, if I could provide some advice to congressional leadership, you know, injecting some stability into the budget process, being able to look out more than just 2 years at a time and to actually do the kind of planning that the defense is actually really good at. I mean, DOD is actually really good at mid-range planning. They haven't been able to do that since 2011, right? And if we can give them the kind of certainty they need to build a balanced program and to make sure that the military can support the strategy that we expect from the administration, you know, that's where I'd spend my time.
Excellent. Well, those are wonderful bits of parting wisdom that I'm sure will be absolutely heeded as we go forward in these budget negotiations in the next couple of weeks. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Susanna.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
All right.
All right.
Let's move on to keeping up foreign relations, which this week has one of my least favorite topics, and it violates one of my fundamental rules of, I don't know, punditry, which is to say never talk about Israeli-Palestinian peace process.
Pretty much, except in my family, we do so on a not so infrequent basis. But yeah, let's talk about Jerusalem.
Great.
Not next year in Jerusalem, but right now.
Right now. This year in Jerusalem, we have, by we, I mean the Trump administration has recognized Jerusalem as the political capital of Israel and the location of the future location of the American embassy, which I think to a lot of people, they would be surprised by this. I mean, I would guess that most folks don't know that the American embassy is, in fact, in Tel Aviv.
I mean, including like various press secretaries have no idea that this is true. So like, this is actually kind of a weird fact, all in all.
And it's part of a weird policy. It dates back to the founding of Israel in the 1967 war and a whole bunch of other things. But the status of Jerusalem has long been held to be a topic for final status negotiations between Israel and Palestine. And the American official position, literally until last week, was that was just that. There would be a part of a political negotiation in future final status talks. we have, in the words of Nikki Haley, advanced the peace process by taking Jerusalem off the table.
Which except is that's not what President Trump said.
Sort
really.
Of a galaxy brain moment that I'm not fully following.
Yeah, not really.
But where are we on this? I mean, there was lots of Sturm und Drang leading up to the announcement. Trump had sort of talked about doing it several times. To be fair, basically every political candidate talks about doing this.
Yep.
Where does that leave us today?
I would just add there's a little additional wrinkle, which is Jerusalem itself has like a east part and a, like, is a divided capital. And so
that's right.
What Trump's announcement didn't totally resolve is America's sort of ambiguity and or support of this divided versus undivided Jerusalem, which would be a really big issue in the peace talks.
That's really the crux of the matter is because he didn't say undivided. He left this open as a possible matter of negotiation in any final status negotiations, which is a good thing, except for the fact that it just basically gave a rhetorical win over to the Israelis, one that they've been looking for a while and one that Trump promised them while not actually doing a whole lot practically, gives nothing to the Palestinians at all. I guess it kind of takes us off the table, but at the end of the day, there's a reason why this is something that past negotiations were never really able to get to. It's because it's a big deal.
And also, did we get anything from the Netanyahu government in exchange for this massive political concession from the Americans?
No, it was basically recommended. Everyone said, please don't do this.
And by everyone, you mean Secretary Mattis, Secretary Tillerson, yes. Most of the National Security Council.
And in my favorite processes by Valentine moment of this entire process, when on Tuesday, President Trump actually did what he was supposed to and like called some of his Arab counterparts to say, hey, by the way, as you've heard, I'm going to announce Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. When they pushed back on this, they hadn't given any kind of guidance to the press to say, like, here's our talking points, here's our position or anything like that. So the press hears of this formally is from all of the Arab leaders who are pissed as hell that this is going on. So they haven't laid any groundwork about like why this is a good idea or useful. It's all the negative reactions from Jordan and others saying like, this is a horrible idea. We're going to see violence in the streets. Americans are going to be at risk. So the story that they could have controlled had absolutely no control whatsoever.
Process right, so that's what I was going to say. Even if he didn't want to extract a formal concession from the Israeli government in terms of giving this big bargaining chip, there was no effort done to spin this or do anything to minimize the downside effect on Arab countries that we want to cooperate with on a host of other issues. So it seems like not only is it problematic in this context of the Mideast peace process, which, you know, it's hard for me to know how unique this problem is, given that we've never really been able to reach a viable solution one way or the other. And this maintains this undivided ambiguity. But it certainly is clear that it's unambiguously bad with respect to relations with our Arab neighbors. And that part wasn't mitigated at all.
Well, and I will sort of play devil's advocate here, which is that the Palestinian issue is a very useful issue for a lot of Arab governments, Jordan in particular. They are happy to sort of let domestic publics vent steam around this issue, but also happy to do basically nothing to actually viably assist the Palestinian people or typically meaningfully pursue the peace process. So I'm, you know, I'll take their histrionics with a little bit of a grain of salt. There were some protests over the weekend. I wouldn't say that they are per se, that the region is engulfed in protests or that there is destabilizing activity in the quote unquote Arab street. But I think that there is, you know, certainly there are folks who will say, you know, kind of on both sides of whether this, I've heard people say that this doesn't undermine the peace process because there was no viable peace process. I've heard others say that it totally undermines the U.S. effort to be an impartial mediator. Meanwhile, on the other hand, and now we're on a third hand, which is basically how this whole process works, that the U.S. hasn't been impartial for some time. And so this just reveals that the Americans have been in bed with the Israelis for a decade or more. And that, you know, this now at least all the cards are on the table. So, I mean, I think we'll see what the long term implications of this are. Hard to know if they'll be quite as dire as many opponents have predicted, but it does seem to, I mean, in the near term, it seems to be a weird own goal to my mind.
Yeah.
So
next year we'll check on this. Maybe from Jerusalem. You never know.
You never know. Speaking of own goals, can we talk about Brexit for a minute?
Let's do so.
Good grief.
But they made some progress, guys. They really did.
Did they?
They kind of did. They came to agreement.
Are we calling
on,
it progress?
Well, like they decided to stop talking about three things. It's like when you're in your marriage or in your relationship and you're just like, you know what? I'm just going to stop talking about the way you brush your teeth because I've moved on to other things. They've now moved
for
on
example.
To other things.
Really having your heart apart, but...
They have moved on. They've come to some semi-agreement that I still don't fully understand on the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, on the status of UK citizens living in the EU and vice versa, and the quote-unquote
divorce bill, which I think is amazing. I love the idea of right. like British alimony being paid to the EU after they leave.
A $50 billion euro, whatever it is, divorce bill.
Yeah, I mean, so this has, you know, been sort of interesting. RTE, the Irish state network, had an incredible TikTok, we'll include in the notes here, of what all went on basically last week, Monday to Friday, as these negotiations were allegedly finished, then totally fell apart when the DUP, which is a Northern Irish Conservative Party that's sort of part of the May coalition government in London, basically balked at what they thought was the special status of Northern Ireland. And then there was several days of like crash negotiations where they put together some very, I mean, interesting diplomatic language, moving from basically full compliance to full alignment, which I think is the new language in the agreement, which is that the Northern Irish...
It's just so British.
It's very British. But it has real implications for the way that the European Union plays into the Northern Ireland peace process and the importance of not reintroducing a hard border between the
That's
six
right.
counties of Ulster and the Republic of Ireland is incredibly important, both economically. I mean, in terms of real day-to-day economic activity, I'm reminded that the IRA itself was funded on smuggling for basically 20 years. And in order to have smuggling, you have to have customs differences. It has to be cheaper in one place than it is in the other. And so that was an interesting random fact in my brain. But we have at least, we've basically made it through the phase one negotiations. Those were culminated last week on Friday. And now we move to phase two, which everyone seems to think is going to be harder than phase one. So congratulations, Brexit.
Phase two is basically the UK saying like, so we want to leave the EU, except we don't really.
Yeah.
And so there was some speculation as I was reading up on this that the terms negotiated basically with regard to Northern Ireland could allow for very favorable trading terms for all of the UK with the EU. And the question is whether politically May can maintain her political coalition with a very soft Brexit versus those who are looking for a much harder Brexit, moving away from the EU regulations that would be essentially less than quote unquote full alignment, which would provide opportunities for the UK to have sort of easier trade deals with the US and Australia, who have fewer regulations than the EU does. So, I mean, these are kind of detailed economic negotiations and trade details that a lot of national security folks don't always pay a ton of attention to. But it turns out, I mean, we're talking about border security here. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about essentially the relationship between, you know, our closest ally in Europe, the United Kingdom, and the rest of Europe. These things end up having real political implications that we're not always great at highlighting and bringing to the fore.
Sort of bigger picture, and we'll come to this, I think, when we talk about the national security strategy too, this return to sort of protectionism and mercantilist policies is a real sort of theme in the national security world, where we're really have two major powers, the UK in the context of Brexit and the US really in the context of the new national security strategy, moving to this protectionist and away from a liberal world order kind of view. And we need to kind of think a little bit about what that means for alliances, NATO, joint defense funding, collective defense, all of that, right? That all is rolled into this.
Well, it is potentially a move away from an increasingly integrated and globalist set of regimes, or globalized regimes, more towards spheres of influence, which is certainly how the world was ordered through the 19th century, for example. But let's use that as a segue to White House Mayhem, and The National Security Strategy, which is due out on December 18th.
I'm just going to pour some more eggnog for that.
You do that. I mean, that's not really what I would choose to drink, but it has so much whiskey that you might as well.
It's 30 proof.
I was like, I mean, really? Is it really eggnog, or is it just a combination of rum and blended whiskey?
I've never seen an opaque drink that was 30 proof before.
But also, why would you drink rum and blended whiskey? It's why eggnog is so terrible. Anyway, we digress.
Anyway, Kate Brennan had an amazing piece this week where she basically got the entire national security strategy leaked to her in The Atlantic and Just Security. And some amazing facts emerged from this. Most notably to me is that it is 70 pages.
Nadia Shadlow has been busy.
That's long.
Is that noticeably longer than previous documents?
That is noticeably longer than previous documents. That's when a Christmas tree has become like the Nutcracker Christmas tree. So the story about strategies is basically that at the end of the day, people just like hang on them whatever their favorite thing is, because a strategy has to become something that has every identifiable priority on the face of the earth.
And that's how you get two sentences on Africa and two sentences on climate change, and everything is a priority.
Exactly. So this is the Nutcracker Christmas tree with at 70 pages, which is either in a marvelous dissertation that nobody will ever read, or is, I don't even know what, maybe it's in another language.
And I have not read the full document yet. Just the article in The Atlantic that Lauren referenced. It does not seem to be a 2002 style Bush NSS. It is not a total re-envisioning of, it doesn't introduce a new doctrine of preemption, for example. It seems to, in some ways, closely hew to previous, paths of competition and I'm going to redo that. It seems to closely hew to previous strategies in some ways. I mean, the major sections are defend the homeland, advance American influence, American prosperity, and peace through strength.
Which, I mean, except for peace through strength, you could probably find most of those phrases in a bunch of other national security strategies before. So
I'm just confused, like, what took 70 pages to hash through if they weren't massively changing.
I think they had to write all of the stuff that everyone agrees with at the beginning and then write a totally different foreign policy in the last section where we return to protectionism and mercantilism.
So it's like the QDR where we have one interesting section and then we agree to split the defense budget a third, a third, a third.
That's right.
Super.
The Carnegie Endowment has a piece by Salman Ahmed sort of dealing with this mercantilism idea sort of straight on, which is this last section of the national security strategy talking about protectionism and a fundamentally competitive world order. So this is not, we have allies, we cooperate on shared defense interests. This is, even our allies are our competitors in the international space. There's only one king of the hill. We're the king of the hill now. And, you know, we need to maintain that strategy and that maintain that position. And that is with respect to peer competitors like Russia and China, but also with
Germany and Japan,
allies like the UK and Germany. Yeah, Japan, where economic competitiveness really matters in a way that it hasn't in the past for our national security priorities.
I'll be honest, this sounds really lonely and maybe a kind of weird analogy for Donald Trump's life of being somebody who is very wealthy and feels like he should be respected, but isn't really amongst his peers.
Well, there was articles very early on in the administration talking about that he, you know, made his bones as a Manhattan real estate developer. And Manhattan real estate is defined fundamentally as zero sum because there's a finite amount of land. And so there's no such thing as win-win. There's no such thing as grow the pie because the island's not getting any bigger. And so everything has to be this kind of zero-sum competition. I've definitely heard, Radha, this discussion of competitive strategies, often with regard to China, which is an evolution you can see in kind of earlier times as well. But the idea that we're in economic competition and that has security implications with Germany and Japan, I mean, that just seems like it's like a small thread in a sweater that we're going to pull and it will unravel for a very long time. I find that really concerning.
I mean, in a factual sense, are we economic competitors with Germany and Japan? Yes, of course we are. We're economic competitors with everyone. But in the broader sense of, does that mean that our national security priorities should be dictated by trade imbalances? It's not clear that it should be. And frankly, the history of the last 50 to 75 years suggests it probably shouldn't be. I mean, we've done a pretty good job with Europe. Our alliance with Japan has yielded, you know, a lot of stability, if not solutions to North Korea, which is a growing issue. And for sure, NATO expansion and the Russia issue is now causing us some friction, but it's not clear that the protectionism stance really deals with the growing threats on that frontier. So it's not clear that this is sort of factually, empirically borne out, but it certainly appears to be what this administration's sort of world doctrine is.
And it certainly doesn't suggest that we're going to, I don't know, at some point invest in a process like the TPP to counter Chinese influence in East Asia. I mean, it's like every man for themselves. And it's hard to, you know, one of the America's greatest strengths in the world over the last 50, almost 75 years actually has been the alliance system. I was at a talk a few weeks ago, talking about sort of Chinese economic statecraft and, you know, the idea that in order to be a leader, you have to have followers. And, you know, followers actually need some sort of vision or regime to buy into. And China still doesn't offer any of that. And so the idea that we would just cede that playing field to some, I don't know, mercantilist or sphere of influence concept, I find it dubious, but I also find it sad. I find it profoundly sad. So, I mean, at some level, I'm interested in reading the full document. Well, that's too strong a statement.
I'm willing interested in reading an excerpts,
you know, the full document when it comes out. But it'll be even more interesting to see how this is actually implemented and what the interagency can and will do with a document like this. It should shape the national military strategy and the national defense strategy, which should nest underneath it and will come out sometime in 2018.
Yeah, it usually comes out in late January or early February timeline. Well, national military strategy comes out later. National defense strategy comes out a bit before that. But in reality, these never quite all nest together. It's more right. That they attempt to like steal various phrases from one another and be somewhat aligned in some form or fashion. I will say, like, I am moderately impressed that they actually attempted to write and rationalize a Trumpian view of the world in the national security strategy, because they could have just completely ignored it altogether and done the...
Well, Kate's view is that they didn't right. rationalize it.
But Salman's view is that, and he's gotten briefed on the other pieces of it, is that they did attempt to rationalize it in some form, at least in some piece of it, which... This is always the problem with national security strategies, where you start out with like a core of a document that really does reflect the president. And then in coordination and interagency review, it grows and becomes something that is something beyond that. So it will be interesting to try to extract like what is the real version and what's the interagency coordinated version. My inspiration now is that this is basically like the Mad Men of national security strategies, the Don Draper version, where it's sad, depressed man drinking alone in his room, very rich, but very alone.
And if I could just one last, and not to be a sort of defender of the Trumpian worldview, but I think there is this lingering issue of, look, we did have this liberal world order, and we do have, in many ways, a lot of successes from the alliance system, but we also had a massive failure in the economic financial markets in terms of growth at certain levels in the U.S., and the view that these internationalist policies are responsible for that or what's generating this. And I think what the case that isn't being made right now is why those internationalists, as they're called, as the sort of Steve Bannon camp would call it,
globalist
policies actually help and preserve the U.S. in the way that the people who are hurting right now experience it. And I think that's what the sort of some of the critiques and analysis of this need to provide. And so it'll be interesting to see kind of the framing on that side, because I will say that there was a framing here to link our national security strategy with these economic concerns that Trump has been very forthright and direct about prioritizing.
So before we move on, we have a couple of personnel notes, I think, and we'll hold detailed discussion until these changes come to fruition, because we always have lots of speculation. It sounds like the administration is about to formally nominate Victor Cha as the ambassador to South Korea. So that would be nice to have, I don't know, before the Olympics or a global thermonuclear war or whatever is going to come next on the peninsula.
You're just being excessive.
There is some discussion that Dina Powell, who's the deputy national security advisor, is going to step down down basically at the 1 year mark, so sometime in January, and that Nadia Shadlow, the author of the National Security Strategy, will step up and take her place. And then, of course, last week, the week before, 10 years ago, it's so hard to tell anymore, there was a lot of discussion about whether Tillerson was finally and effectively on the way out to be replaced by CIA Director Pompeo, who himself will be replaced by Senator Tom Cotton. And I guess that merry-go-round, the music hasn't quite stopped yet. So they're all still in their current positions. And we'll keep an eye on that. Is that where we are on that front?
More or less. But can you imagine if your boss or others had leaked these horrible stories that you were leaving or being fired about you in the news? Like, would you stay? I would be out in a heartbeat.
I mean, in some ways,
I am like a total weakling. But like,
I mean, at some level, this is the classic Trumpian process. He wants them all to jump. He does not want to push hardly any of them. I mean, the only people, I mean, I guess Mike Flynn technically resigned, as did Tom Price, but they resigned under pressure. But you know, there's not a lot of firing going on, and so it's actually kind of interesting to think if Tillerson just doesn't give a fork and is willing to stay on indefinitely, under what conditions would Trump actually fire him if, in fact, he wants a new Secretary of State? So it's not usually the case that the 1 year mark is the big departure point. I mean, it's usually
at least 2 years.
2 years or the end of the first term. But I will be intrigued to see what sort of personnel moves, especially at the National Security Council, might come in January and February. So.
And if those moves come with, you know, undersecretaries and assistant secretaries, just put it out there as an option.
The Pentagon is increasingly fleshed out. The State Department's still a ghost town, and in some ways increasingly so. All right, we already talked about the budget, so we don't need to talk about that under what's next. The continuing resolution occurs until 22nd of December. Mm-hmm. What else is next, ladies?
Well, what's next to me is the Olympics that's coming up in the earlier the next year. And the reason that's important to me is because a number of people have been talking about the fact that, like, after the Olympics, guess what, guys?
We can go to war in Korea.
Yay! So speaking of, you know, national security strategies, this is apparently something that's under great debate. So the blob has it within the national security world about whether or not we're actually going to go to war in North Korea.
It's under great debate behind closed doors.
Right.
So Corey Shockey had a very good article over the weekend that kind of mirrored some sentiments that I had expressed as well, which was that in some ways this debate around North Korea, the idea of a window closing, the idea of a non-deterrable adversary, feels very similar to the Iraq debate, with one exception. The Iraq debate was very public.
Extremely public.
It was occurring in Congress. It was occurring in television. It was occurring at the UN. There was no mistaking what the Bush administration wanted to do in late 2002 and early 2003 and the lengths they were willing to go to pursue that.
And it involved our allies to a large degree.
Well, there was an effort to recruit our allies, and that's what part of the debate was at the UN. Ultimately, the Brits and Australians joined. The French, most notably, at the time, did not. But the idea that, but none of that, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm like not listening to the right channels or hearing the right podcasts or something, but I'm not hearing any public debate around the North Korea strategy.
But two things. One, I mean, we are doing these exercises with our allies. We have an exercise with Japan and South Korea this week on practicing tracking missiles, which is a handy thing that we should totally practice. But it's not totally clear to me that decisions are made through debate and discussion here, right? Like, let's be clear. The president of the United States has been very clear what he thinks about the leader of North Korea and that he wants a firm hand and, you know, isn't planning to provide any quarter. So maybe the decision is he one day decides he's ready for war and he calls in the Secretary of Defense and rocks it out.
Like, you're not making me feel any better, Radha.
But I mean, the thing is, though,
I'm just saying, enjoy the holidays. They may be the last.
the way that the president and McMaster are talking about North Korea, we would be crazy to not go to some kind of preventive war with North Korea. Like, that would be absolutely the thing to do. It's just a matter of, like, are they saying this because they think it's some kind of strange coercion measure?
No, I think they would very much like for you to come to that conclusion.
Okay. Great.
So that's disappointing. Let's talk about our gift guide.
Yay!
Do we have other pop culture notes, I guess I should say? I watched The Crown and finished it this weekend.
I haven't quite finished it yet. I'm mostly sad about how much it is focused on Prince Philip, because Queen Elizabeth is clearly the most important character.
Yes, but it will make you hate Philip. And so that's a handy conclusion to come
to. But he has amazing cheekbones. His cheekbones you could like cut diamonds with.
Well, he is a Danish prince. You know, what are you going to do? The episode with Edward VIII, with Uncle David.
Oh, my God.
Is extraordinary and is very much all about why you should remember that he was a goddamn Nazi.
Yes, and he is still possibly my favorite character in the entire season one for sure, possibly season two.
That's interesting.
Not season two in the sense that like I like Nazis, but season two in the sense that like he is the most well-developed and fascinating person I think in the entire series.
He's allowed to have the richest inner dialogue, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I have been saving The Crown to watch, but I'm caught up on Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, which is a
also amazing
and amazing, totally amazing show. But luckily, I love spoilers, so I feel like this is all just real.
I mean, the fact that
you guys are just weirdos, I can't believe it.
The fact that King Edward was a Nazi is not a spoiler.
Not a
so
spoiler.
Much. It's just, no, it's the cheekbone style that really.
Also, Margaret gets married. In case you didn't know,
right?
Don't let me tell you what happens in season three.
There's all kinds of amazing relationship dynamics in this that I have done crazy googling on.
Town and Country is all over this for your okay. Crown fact checking.
Okay,
yeah.
Nicole Cliff is also doing an exceptional job of recapping, but slowly, so hurry up.
Gift guide? Radha, you've got some explaining to do.
Guys, a couple of things. One, sparkly Rothy's.
They're amazing. I'm very interested in them. I'm not going
to
lie.
I tried to order two pairs, but they don't have them in my size, but you can sign up to be emailed when your size comes back in stock.
Well,
and
fabulous.
Rothy's, if you're listening, seriously, let's talk about this podcast, guys. So, you know, I haven't been sleeping a lot with this new baby, and I have.
Oh, by the way, Radha has a new baby.
I have a new baby. He's adorable and delightful, but, you know, not entirely on board with sleeping for extended periods of time just yet, which leaves me lots of time to Google random things on the internet and read all sorts of books and
reviews. Economics books.
Okay. First of all, economics books are cool.
I don't know about that, honey.
And secondly, I categorize them into not for the faint of heart and more fun ones. And some of them are things like naked economics and naked statistics, which are fun and tongue in cheek and can help you learn your favorite statistical distribution so you too can have an answer.
I would like the record to reflect these were Radha's ideas and not mine. Lauren, what's your favorite thing on the gift guide?
So first of all, everyone should know that all of our favorite booze that we have received or had on the podcast is all on the gift guide. My new obsession this year is Korean sheet masks for your face. Oh. Men or women, this is the best thing that's ever happened to you. Trust me, putting a sheet mask on your face in the evening is just like a lovely, relaxing moment. As are bath bombs. My bath bombs are on there. Those are great.
They are great.
And then also I will note that I think the three of us have become somewhat obsessed with the Banksy bomb hugger paraphernalia.
Love it.
There's an Etsy link on there. I highly recommend everyone should put this on your laptop, on your wall, wherever you so choose.
Also in the art category is my favorite Steve Thomas art, who does some excellent Star Wars themed travel art. Also, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, that's who did the Clue infographic, which is basically peak Aaron. But there are, we'll have this up this week. There are lots of, I think, random. There's a lot of random things on this list.
That's right.
It's a mix of books and booze and facial care.
Smoked meat.
And smoked meat. So basically something for everybody.
Mail order wine.
And we hope that folks really like it. So on that much happier note, we will see you all for a year in review episode in about a week or so. And hope everyone has a happy holiday season.
Happy holidays.
Bye.